From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're taking a long, in-depth look at the story of Mosley Career Readiness Academy. The story started with a scoop late last year. My colleague Rachel Keith reported the Academy's high school program was closing abruptly. The news was met with surprise and frustration from parents and board members, and public pushback swiftly followed. This was a beloved program, sometimes called a school within a school, that supported students who needed a little extra help to get ready for life after graduation. And there was bipartisan support for keeping the program open, and frustration with Superintendent Dr. Charles Faust, who was accused of springing the decision on the public and elected officials. But a month later, the story had evolved, mutated even, into something quite different. A debate over a proposed newcomer school. That's a school designed to help recent immigrants acclimate to the U.S., culturally and academically. And that seemed to serve as a referendum on the broader national conversation about immigration and all of the narratives and misinformation that come along with that debate. And all of that, basically, is how we ended up receiving the phone message I'm about to play for you right now. And just a note, this is pretty intense, so listener discretion is advised.
This is a message for Dr. Faust. Wonder if he's related to Fauci. The criminal who wants to shut down a special needs American school and reopen for, what did he call them, newcomers? Is that the new catchphrase for the illegal criminal aliens? I hope he gets picked up tonight by the United States Marine Corps, handcuffs slapped on him, thrown into the back of a Jeep, and taken on a ship to Guam, where he gets a swift military tribunal and hangs the next day for treason. Because it's an open and closed case, and Americans are pissed, and frankly, I'm almost as pissed off that I can't watch these hangings live. I want to watch people like him hung on live TV.
Best we can tell, that's a woman named Kathleen Roscoe. She's from Arizona, where, according to local media, she's made similar comments suggesting violent revolution or the death penalty for Maricopa County officials over election concerns back in 2022. For what it's worth, we shared this phone message with law enforcement, who looked into it but found it didn't rise to the level of a criminal threat. I'm not sure that's any comfort for Dr. Faust, who we're told received other similarly hostile messages about the proposed newcomer school. And one hopes that Ms. Roscoe is an extreme outlier, outside the Overton window, like way outside the window, of any civil debate over a newcomer school or immigration in general. But it's worth asking, how did things go so far off the rails here? How did someone in Arizona end up weighing in, regardless of how deranged their comments were, on school policy here in New Hanover County? Roscoe didn't respond to email or phone message we left for her, so we can't ask her her motives directly. But there are some clues in how the Mosley story unfolded. Again, this story started as something very different back in December of 2023, when my colleague Rachel Keith first reported it. A few days later, Mosley students took to a Board of Education meeting to speak in defense of their program.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Jeremiah Castillo. I'm a junior at Mosley, and I've been going there for all 3 years of high school. We have Brazilian kids, we have Jamaican kids, we have Caribbean, we have Asian kids, and everybody there feels so comfortable with each other.
Now, it's precisely because of the more intensive support that these students got that Mosley was on the chopping block. That level of attention to students costs money, and the district, facing what would later be revealed to be a $20 million budget shortfall, was looking for places to save money. But the students' testimonials hit home, and few people felt like this was the right way to go about trimming fiscal fat. At the same time that this was happening, there was another longer-term proposal being put out there, building a newcomer school, and Mosley's campus was suggested as one possible location for the school. Dr. Faust would later acknowledge that discussions about the newcomer school had been going on for several years, but there had been little public discussion about it until November of last year, where administrators gave a brief presentation. And initially, the reaction was positive. Republican board member Pat Bradford called the plan, quote, fabulous. That's a comment she'd end up working hard to distance herself from as the story started to evolve. Okay, now flash forward to this year, in January, and New Hanover County Commissioner Dane Scalise waded into the debate. Scalise, who was appointed to the board after the death of Commissioner Deb Hayes last year, is now running as a Republican to keep his board seat in the 2024 election. Now, while county commissioners fund a significant portion of the school district's budget, they often take a hands-off approach on school policy. But Scalise argued that the power of the purse gave them the opportunity to weigh in. And weigh in he did, voicing what was, by that point, the almost universal support for keeping Moseley open, but also asking for a resolution to block any attempt to open a newcomer school.
Gosh, what happens whenever you put one of these newcomer schools into a county like New Hanover? And a newcomer school, in case that you're not aware, it's not really a school in the traditional sense. It's more akin to a migrant resettlement or assimilation facility. Well, Guilford County put one in. They led the state in this endeavor. And it was so successful, according to a WNC article published on October 11th, 2023, that Guilford County has subsequently experienced a rapid influx of immigration, that's a quote, and become a hub for refugee resettlement. Become so popular that they just opened up a second newcomer school in Guilford County. We are talking about closing down a school that is helping a remarkable success that has been meeting the critical needs of those not currently served elsewhere in our school system. We're going to close a school for existing citizens and students of New Hanover County, and we're even considering putting a newcomer school into New Hanover County.
Scalise would fine-tune his argument in an opinion piece published in the Carolina Journal a few days later. And again, Scalise stated that, quote, the purported mission of these facilities is not to educate students in the traditional sense, but to allegedly help entire immigrant and refugee families integrate into the local community where they are relocated. He also reiterated his earlier claim that opening a newcomer school would mean that New Hanover County would, quote, rapidly become a magnet to migrant families from outside of the country. In support of these claims, Scalise cited the reporting of our colleague Liz Schlimmer, who covers education for WUNC in Chapel Hill and the Triangle. So I contacted Schlimmer, and she confirmed that the two newcomer schools in Guilford County are very much schools. They teach the same curriculum set by the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction that other public schools teach. And, just to be sure, our own Camille Mojica spent the day at the Sylvia Mendez Newcomer School. That's the second newcomer school to open in Guilford County, just to make sure. We'll hear more from Cami later in the show, but long story short, she also confirmed it's very much an actual school. I also asked Schlimmer about Scalise's other claim, that a newcomer school would drive immigration to the region. She called that idea absurd, noting that none of her sources had suggested anything like that. She pointed instead to larger global forces driving immigration from Central America and Africa, and to Guilford County's deep history of refugee resettlement. As we've noted in our reporting in the past, Guilford County, and Greensboro in particular, does have a long and rich history of immigration, dating back to the 1970s, where federally backed refugee resettlement programs, working with the Lutheran Church, have helped people fleeing political violence escape Southeast Asia and later Sub-Saharan Africa. This history of resettlement has created a large immigrant community. There are around 100 different languages spoken there, and it's the most diverse place I've ever been outside of Flushing in Queens, New York. Now, refugees are a special class of immigrant. The process they go through takes years before they even get to the U.S., and once they get here, they're required to get a job. In fact, they have to take the first job offer they get and start paying their way. They're even required to eventually pay the U.S. government back for the airfare into the country. They also get a green card and a social security number and the benefits that go along with that. But the vibrant and diverse community that those refugees have founded in the Greensboro area has been attractive to other immigrants, whether they're asylum seekers, naturalized citizens, or, yes, undocumented migrants. And, as we'll discuss with Cami later on the show, that seems like a more plausible explanation for the influx in migrants than the schools. As Schlimmer told me, she'd never heard of anyone leaving their home and moving to the U.S., to Guilford County, just so their kid could spend 1 year in a newcomer school. Because that's all the time immigrant children are allowed to spend at one of these newcomer schools. That's because federal law prohibits basically corralling all of the foreign-born kids in one school for their whole K-12 educational career. So, bottom line, Scalise seemed to have it wrong on both counts. Now, before writing and recording this show, I reached out to Scalise to ask him if he wanted to add some context or update his opinion, but he politely declined and basically stood his ground, as he did back in January when we first discussed the role Guilford's history had on immigration versus the building of a newcomer school. Scalise said people could come to their own conclusions. As for whether or not a newcomer school is, quote, really a school, we got into it a little bit on X, formerly Twitter. I said that his quote about newcomer schools not being designed to educate students was inaccurate, and he countered that he'd never claimed the schools didn't teach the NCDPI curriculum. And honestly, Twitter, no matter what name it goes by, is a lousy place to have a debate, so we left it there, and I'll leave it here for his comments. But the story didn't end with Scalise's opinion. The day after Scalise put forward his resolution, president of the local Moms for Liberty chapter and Republican school board candidate Natasha Tu stepped into the fray. Tu, who has since won in the primary election, appeared on Steve Bannon's War Room, a podcast with a national audience. Now, we could do an entire newsroom on Bannon, but suffice to say, he's a longtime political operative, an advisor to former President Donald Trump, and champion of the so-called alt-right. He was accused of fraud but pardoned by Trump and was kicked off of Twitter after suggesting Anthony Fauci and FBI Director Christopher Wray should be executed. And Bannon is, at least in media circles, most famous for his philosophy of, quote, flood the zone with shit. Basically, jam so much misinformation into the media cycle that people can't tell what's true and won't bother to figure it out for themselves. Bannon interviewed Tu about Mosley and the newcomer school, while running B-roll of immigrants crowded at the U.S.-Mexico border in the background.
Natasha Tu from New Hanover County in North Carolina, the Tar Heel State, joins us. Ma'am, you're one of the chairman of the Moms for Liberty down there. Tell me about this debacle with the schools down there, what's actually going on with this invasion by these illegal aliens.
Thanks, Steve, for having me. Less than 6 weeks ago, I was attending our regular school board meeting, and that's when we learned that the only special needs school, the only high school that is designed to educate our special needs students, was being shut down. And we learned that they were shutting this down to make room for refugees.
Now, Tu's not exactly right about Mosley being the only school for special needs students, but it's more interesting to me that she confuses refugees with the more general immigrant population served by newcomer schools. Bannon continued the interview, and Tu shared some inaccurate but telling information.
Are you telling this audience that the parents got a notification for their special needs kids that the one location for special needs education in this area was being shut down for American citizens who have special needs to open it up for the illegal alien invaders that are come? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, if I may, they call it the newcomer school. If that makes you feel any better, we know what it is. It's a refugee center. There's actually one in Greensboro, North Carolina, Steve. It's called the, American Hebrew Academy in Greensboro. And that's a full-on on-campus living with wraparound services. Wrap your head around what wraparound services may mean.
Now, there was an American Hebrew Academy in Guilford County. It was a private Jewish school that failed financially. And currently, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has a 5-year, $50 million lease of the Academy campus. That's to run a facility for unaccompanied immigrant children who are waiting to be reunited with their family or placed in a sponsor home. And there are indeed wraparound services, since children will sleep, eat, and go to school there. But importantly, this is not the newcomer school in Guilford County. It has, however, been a hot-button issue with Republicans in Congress, some of whom have written a letter pushing back against the facility, including Congressman David Rauser. And I almost can't believe I'm saying this, but to Steve Bannon's credit, he tried to ask, too, if the newcomer school she was talking about was a federal or county or local program. But Tu pivoted away, instead calling for Faust to be fired and saying that was the reason she was running for school board. After initially agreeing to comment on her statements here, Tu didn't actually respond to specific questions. So it's not clear where she got her information from, how she confused the federal facility with a county-run school, or, for that matter, how she feels about the language Bannon used. What is clear is that the misinformation too shared on Bannon's show further mutated the narrative of the Mosley story. As evidence, Kathleen Roscoe's phone message, which we played at the top of this show, came in just a few hours after Tu appeared on Bannon's War Room. And as of this week, that strand of misinformation still persists. During a school board meeting, Pat Bradford tried to explain and distance herself from her initial support of the newcomer school by saying she'd since learned more about it.
In doing so, I learned it wasn't a school to teach students English as much as it was an immigration center with wraparound services funded at taxpayers' expense. I wondered, did the people living around Mosley off Princess Place Drive, did they know this was slated to happen to their neighborhood?
And this is the story I've heard from some people out in the community, and at calls to the audience at school board meetings, and on Nick Craig's conservative morning show, which has touched on the issue several times. The narrative has become, a newcomer school isn't a school at all. It's a center for refugees. It's rolling out the welcome mat for all types of immigrants, including dangerous, hardened criminals. It's also, in part because of Tu's appearance on Bannon's War Room, become increasingly common to hear newcomer schools referred to as camps or centers for illegal aliens. And yes, there are some undocumented minor children going to schools all around the country, whether or not they have a newcomer school. We don't have exact data on this, because a Supreme Court ruling prohibits schools from asking about the immigration status of kids. But statistically, yes, it's happening. But one, we still have a federal mandate to educate those students, and two, the majority of immigrant students are U.S.-born children, or children in the process of securing citizenship through refugee or asylum processes. On a larger scale, the Mosley story has clearly been connected to the larger debate about immigration policy and border security, and to inaccurate and sometimes hateful myths about immigrants themselves. So the WHQR newsroom set out to poke a few holes in this narrative. Camille Mojica spent the day visiting a newcomer school to see what it really was. Kelly Knoyer crunched the data on who immigrants are, what role they have in our community and economy, and what, if anything, their relationship to crime rates are. And Rachel Keith spoke to experts who work with refugees, asylum seekers, and other immigrants to get a better sense of who we're actually talking about. That's all coming up ahead on today's show. But before we get to that, I want to say I'm pretty sure that after listening to this show, some people will say, we're just advocating for a newcomer school. But honestly, that's not our goal. For one, the issue seems dead on arrival, since last month the school board voted to stop any and all planning for a potential newcomer school, while also voting to keep the Career Readiness Academy at Mosley open for the foreseeable future. And unlike a lot of votes from the politically divided school board, this one was unanimous. But even if it came up in the future, the New Hanover County Schools District is facing a lot of challenges and serious financial issues, and a newcomer school, if it were to come up again as a proposal, might not be the best use of its limited resources. It might have other priorities, and those are up to the school board to decide. But we hope that if the issue does come up again, it'll be debated based on fact, not fiction. I also want to say that since this issue has become inextricably linked to immigration, that we are not advocating one way or the other on those policy debates. There are solid arguments from conservatives and liberals alike for revisiting our current immigration policy, for reshaping it into something that is more efficient, more humane, and something that works with the U.S. economy while still allowing us to be the bastion of hope that we've been, or at least aspired to be, for centuries. All right, we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll be joined by Camille Mojica, who took a first-hand look at what a newcomer school actually looks like. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. As we discussed earlier on today's show, as the Mosley story evolved, the conversation shifted to the idea of a newcomer school, and some of the criticism of a proposed newcomer school was that it wasn't a school at all. And there was good reporting on newcomer schools in Guilford County by WUNC's Liz Schlemmer, but we really wanted to see for ourselves. So my colleague, Camille Mojica, drove up to High Point in Guilford County to see for herself, and here's some of what she reported back.
Morning. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Christian Walter is the principal of the Sylvia Mendez Newcomer School in High Point. It's Guilford County's second newcomer school, opened last year.
I mean, this is a dream for me. That's like, I really fought for this school, like really hard. So this is a dream job for me.
The floors are spotted with green, teal, and blue tiles in groups. According to Walter, the colors were chosen because studies have shown that they have a calming effect. In fact, the whole school is engineered to make students feel comfortable and relaxed. Its computer and media room is full of uniquely shaped chairs, and beanbags line the colorful floor, and at the front of the room is a screen with a fireplace playing soft coffee shop piano music.
I think, you know, education has been one of those unique commitments America has made. You know, the idea that all children, no matter their background or socioeconomic background, that they should have access to a high quality education. This is the constitutional right of kids in America.
For decades, Guilford County has been home to dozens of immigrant communities. Jose Oliva immigrated from Guatemala and became a student at Guilford County's first newcomers school back in 2011, at the time a one-of-a-kind facility that had only been open for a few years. Now he's the county's youngest ever chief of staff. And Oliva calls newcomer schools an investment in future leaders.
And when you think about who leads some of the largest Fortune 500 companies, you know, a big number of those CEOs are immigrants. So it would be a disservice to North Carolina to not invest in the next generation of CEOs and elected leaders. For us, we see it investing in ourselves when we invest in schools like Newcomer School.
Oliva is careful to note the difference between the immigrant and refugee experiences. When you're a refugee, you don't want to move, but you're forced to for safety concerns. That's where the newcomer school steps in as a welcoming pair of open arms, he says. He says he knows there's a vocal minority that oppose newcomer schools, but he says most people support them.
I think that most communities embrace a concept of newcomer schools. So I think most people relate with that American dream story. I do think most people want older students to succeed.
Some pushback against newcomer schools claim they aren't schools at all. But Colleen Dunst, the school's curriculum coordinator, said that's simply not true.
We use the same curriculum that they use in schools around the district. So if a student is in an English 1 class here, they're using the same textbook, the same content that they're using in English 1 in another school.
Newcomer schools follow the state curriculum, with added focus on learning English. And as Principal Walter says, the school helps students build up confidence.
One of our emphasis here, for example, is the fact that we teach our students to advocate for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a life skill that you need when you go to a regular school.
Transitioning from newcomer schools into regular schools is not easy, staff say. Refugee students have already been through a lot, and Walter says taking them away from that dual language environment can pose a serious challenge.
They just feel so safe here and so familiar with the setting. They just go into the unknown. It might trigger some anxiety. So we partner with the SEL.
Social Emotional Learning
Department, and also with UNCG Psychological Services. Sometimes they come and they do sessions with our students as well.
At the end of the day, Walter says newcomer schools are valuable, important, and very real places of education.
That's what we do here in Guilford County, mm-hmm. as we prepare our students that come from different parts of the world so that they are able to become active members of this country. Is they're not going to leave. They're going to stay here.
In response to criticism of the idea from public figures in New Hanover County, Walter says,
I think that they can do better.
Oliva concluded.
So I hope that, they find a way to serve all kids. It doesn't have to be one at the expense of the other, but they can serve all kids. And, I have my eyes on New Hanover. I think they're going to do great things.
All right, Cami Mojica, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, as we heard, you went to the Sylvia Mendez Newcomer School up in Guilford County to find out for yourself what a newcomer school actually is. And this is actually the second school the county has opened. So you went, you saw, what was it like?
Well, first, I heard a lot of laughter. I saw a lot of smiling faces from both students and staff. Everyone was very welcoming to us and happy to have us. It's clear Guilford County is proud of their newcomer schools.
And right up top, I gotta ask, to be clear, this is a school? Because as we've touched on, some have claimed it is not.
Right. I mean, it's very much a school. It looks like a school. It's full of teachers and classrooms. It's a school. It does have a mission to help acclimate students to American culture and education. And there are some extra services provided for students, but that's not at the expense of educating students. They teach the same state curriculum. The one important difference, I would say, is that students can only attend for 1 year before they move to a regular school.
Right, because otherwise they'd be running afoul of federal law, which prohibits segregating kids.
Exactly.
Okay, so when it comes to those kids, how do they end up attending one of these two newcomer schools?
Well, it's an opt-in program, so when families move to Guilford County and go to central office to register their kids to attend, they're asked whether or not they want their students to go to a newcomer school. It's K through 12, so they have classes for every age group.
Okay, so you were telling me earlier that there are some services the school offers to students. What's going on with this?
Yeah, so the school has a food pantry that is fully stocked by the school themselves and from donations from the community. It has what staff call culturally relevant foods, like different kinds of rice, beans, curries, and specialty items. They also have a clothing closet that is also fueled solely by donations from the community. There are washers and dryers so they can wash the donations before they put them out. The school has also built a small clinic that is connected to the building, but it has its own entrance. When I visited, they were still waiting on a partner in the medical community to step in and actually run this clinic and bring in equipment. But the goal is to offer a central location and place for people to come receive basic health care, things like checkups and immunizations.
And you told me in general, you know, the school helps fund some of this or provide space for some of this, but it really is kind of like a community collaborative effort here.
Yes.
All right. I will note here that school staff calls these wraparound services sometimes, but as we touched on earlier in the show, I don't think that's the same thing as school board candidate Natasha Tu is talking about when she says wraparound services. Now, it's not 100% clear what she's suggesting, but it does seem like she's saying in some way there's something nefarious going on here, or maybe just very generous on the taxpayer dime. But I do want to ask, you know, what other services does the school offer?
I will say the schools do conduct needs assessments. So new students and their families are brought in to meet with a social worker who works for the school who can help connect them to services that they need. But the school itself is not administering any of these programs. The school social workers are doing the job that fits their description, and that's getting people help.
And these services that they're being connected to, those would be available to anyone in the area? I mean, this includes things like Medicare, Medicaid, which has some restrictions for some immigrants, and we'll talk about that later in the show. But, like, bottom line, these aren't like a boutique service just for immigrants, right?
That's right. And this is important context to include when we talk about newcomer schools, because there's been a push in the narrative of newcomer schools equals increased illegal immigration and immigrants and refugees taking resources away from taxpayers on their dime.
Right. And a little bit of supposition on my part here, but that's kind of what Natasha Tu's intimations about wraparound services felt like. And we're going to unpack some of the actual economics of immigration with Kelly Knoyer later in this show. But for now, there's another thing I want to unpack, and that's the relationship between the newcomer school and Guilford County and Greensboro's immigrant population. As we mentioned earlier, Commissioner Dane Scalise suggested at a county meeting and later in an opinion piece that opening a newcomer school would cause an influx of its population into the region the way it did in Guilford County.
We heard that argument on Nick Craig's show as well.
And as we've discussed, Guilford County has a long history of serving as a new home for resettled migrants, refugees, and immigrants, long predating the first newcomer school. The county's population of over 500,000 includes over 60,000 members of immigrant communities. They speak over 100 different languages. According to a 2012 report from the UNC Greensboro Center for New North Carolinians, federal grants and other programs, along with faith-based organizations like the Lutheran Church, helped Vietnamese, Cambodians, Laotians all settle in the area during the 1970s and 1980s. And then in the 1990s, Somali and Sudanese immigrants settled in the area. So while statistically, yeah, there's bound to be some undocumented immigrants here, there's a long, long history of legal immigration that, again, predates the first newcomer school opening by decades.
And certainly some immigrants are often looking for communities where they can feel at home to some extent.
Right. I mean, who wouldn't want that? I think back to my Jewish ancestors who moved to the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the 1800s to be around Hebrew-speaking people who shared their culture and their faith and their values. I mean, that's pretty classic immigrant experience 101.
Right. And it seems like that community would be a more compelling reason to pick Guilford County than just to have a single year for a child at a newcomer school.
Right. And I go back to the reporting by Liz Schlemmer, who wrote about this newcomer school for our sister station, WUNC. And whatever the interpretations of her article were, we asked her, and she said none of her sources suggested that the school itself was responsible for an increase in immigration. She said it's really hard to just discount the role of the region's history of refugee resettlement and the geopolitical upheavals in Africa and Central America and just, quote unquote, blame the newcomer school for the influx in immigration. And I know that's not what her article was directly about. It wasn't about the causality of newcomer schools and immigration, but I appreciate her sharing her insight with us. And Cammie, I appreciate you taking an entire day to go and visit the school and see firsthand what it is and what was happening there. So thank you for going, thank you for reporting, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, well, we need to take another quick break, but when we come back, my colleagues Rachel Keith and Kelly Kinoyer will be here. Kelly's going to help us break down some data around immigration, economics, and crime, and Rachel's going to help us take a more human look at immigration and who the immigrants we're talking about actually are. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. As the Mosley story has evolved and become more of a debate about newcomer schools and immigration in general, there's been a lot of numbers thrown around. So with me now is my colleague Kelly Kinoyer to help us crunch some of this data and see what's actually going on. All right, Kelly, you've gone through a trove of immigration data for us, and you're here to help debunk some myths and stereotypes.
That's right. You're a resident data nerd here to nerd out about the data.
Great. Well, let's start with who exactly is immigrating to our community. Are they documented or undocumented, and where are they coming from?
Sure. So according to the census, for New Hanover County, about 12,000 people who live here are foreign-born, which is about 5% of our total population. Out of that, nearly half are naturalized citizens. That means they're not only here legally, but they've been legal residents for at least 5 years and have become true American citizens in every way except birth. To do that, they've gone through an interview process and taken an oath of loyalty to the United States. They also took a test to prove they can speak, read, and write English at a basic level.
Right. I've actually known a few people who've been through this process, and they end up knowing a lot more about civics than a lot of natural-born citizens that I know. They love to pop a quiz me on the Bill of Rights, for example.
And how do you do?
Not as good as they would, but okay. Those are the naturalized citizens. What about those who are here illegally?
Okay, so for unauthorized residents, we don't have county-wide data, but migrationpolicy.org estimates that just under a third of immigrants in North Carolina are undocumented. In terms of who these undocumented folks are, 77% come from Latin America and 10% are from Asia. Around 80% of them have already been in the country for 5 or more years, so they're not exactly newcomers. And a third of the undocumented population lives in poverty, compared to 12% of North Carolinians overall. That makes sense to me, since you have limited work opportunities when you don't have legal status. Despite that, undocumented workforce participation rates are actually a bit higher than the overall population, and there are a number of industries that rely on them, like construction and agriculture.
And don't forget the service industry. I have worked with more than a few undocumented folks in my day. But okay, this is a story about schools, so let's talk about that. As I mentioned earlier on the show, I do hear a lot of concerns from conservatives, including some of my own family and friends, about the tax burden of immigrants. There's plenty of confusion around this. For example, we hear people suggest that undocumented immigrants are getting food stamps, which isn't true, but they are eligible in some cases for Medicaid, like here in North Carolina, but they have to wait for 5 years. And there are some exceptions for asylum recipients, refugees, and people who have been abused or trafficked. Nick Craig has covered this more than a few times on his show, and he spent some time with the author of a piece in the Carolina Journal on the cost of illegal aliens or immigrants in their community. That's the words that they used. And the claim is that undocumented immigrants cost each North Carolinian $5,000 a year, or $3 billion total each year. And they claim education makes up close to $1.5 billion of that.
Yeah, I did some digging on his sources for these numbers, and I figured out that the article was actually citing the Federation for American Immigration Reform, or FAIR. Southern Poverty Law Center classifies that organization as a hate group, and its data has been debunked by the American Immigration Council.
Right. I mean, FAIR was founded by John Tanton, a white supremacist and eugenics enthusiast in the late 1970s. But the organization has pushed back against that hate group designation. But even if we set aside that as an ad hominem attack, they've been criticized for methodological errors and in some cases inflating data.
Yeah. For example, looking at the article, FAIR seems to pull in U.S.-born children of immigrants for its count, which is an inaccurate way of counting immigrants. If a kid is born here, they're not an immigrant. They're a U.S. citizen.
Right. So that muddies the data for sure. The raw total immigration data is also disputed. Migrationpolicy.org, that group that you cited before, puts the estimated total of undocumented people in North Carolina at around 296,000. FAIR has a higher estimate of around 490,000, so significantly more. But let's talk about the tax burden for education, since that's one of the main concerns we've been hearing about here, specifically folks who are juxtaposing the added cost of educating immigrants against the school's pretty significant existing budget hole.
Well, from the census, we know that there are about 1,700 foreign-born people who are enrolled in education institutions in New Hanover County. But only 775 foreign-born residents are between the ages of 5 and 17, and there are more than 900 foreign-born residents enrolled in college or graduate school. So those folks, at least, are paying tuition or they're on scholarships.
And how does that compare to the demographics of the overall population in New Hanover County?
So I think that's an interesting question. About 7% of our foreign-born residents are under 18. By comparison, 17% of the overall population is under 18. In fact, our foreign-born population skews heavily towards working-age adults, and their workforce participation rate is higher than the average population. Most people who work in the United States pay taxes rather than working under the table.
Right, and most migrants come to the United States to work. As you said, they're working-age. And if you listen to conservative talk radio, you'll hear the phrase military age men quite a bit. And that's the same age range, really, but they imply two very different things, I think it's safe to say. It's not as point blank as Steve Bannon calling them an alien invasion, but I think you get the idea. Okay, back to the children. As we've discussed, schools are prohibited from asking families about the immigration status of a student. But for many people I've spoken with, they don't really have a problem with children born in the U.S. who are U.S. citizens getting an education in public schools. Although, that said, there are people, including former President Donald Trump, who have called for an end to birthright citizenship. So I guess I have to say some people do object to that.
Yeah, and the argument FAIR makes is that the children of undocumented immigrants wouldn't be here if not for their parents' decision to come to the U.S.
Right. It's hardly the children's fault, but that, I think, is what people are supposed to take away from the FAIR data used in the Carolina Journal report. It's a concern that these kids are costing taxpayers. And we don't have hard data on that. So I think, yes, if that's a concern you have, statistically, yeah, it's happening. But I don't think that quite gives you the whole picture.
I think the counterargument that our colleague Rachel Keith has heard is that regardless of legal status, immigrants who grow up educated by our school systems, most of them will become contributing members of our society, pay taxes, and over time help cover the cost of public education among other government programs, just like all of us U.S. nationals generally do when we start working. In fact, that's another criticism of FAIR, that they don't show the other side of the ledger. That is, they don't talk about the tax revenue generated by immigrants or the billions of dollars of labor they put into the economy. It's just the cost that they get focused on.
For what it's worth, FAIR admits its own estimates are higher than most other immigration policy organizations. And their calculations about the cost of immigrants to the taxpayer in North Carolina include people who are U.S. citizens. I'll quote here from their methodology description. It's important to note that FAIR includes costs incurred by the minor U.S.-born children of illegal aliens, as these costs are fully attributable to their parents' unlawful residence in the United States. Now, FAIR goes on to explain that they would account for the children's future economic contributions, but they think children of immigrants won't contribute to society like they did in decades prior. Here's another quote. Therefore, if we did attempt to account for their future tax contributions, we would also need to account for their reliance on state and federal benefit programs. This would likely only serve to increase our cost estimates further, not drastically lower it, as many open border advocates insist.
And they don't actually cite any specific studies when they write this, perhaps because they wanted everything to line up with their predetermined conclusion. I really don't think we can take FAIR as a serious source of data given all of this evidence. I mean, this organization has a ticker at the top of their website with a count of illegal border crossings so far that day. And bear with me while I get incredibly deep in the weeds here.
Okay.
I checked their source code of the website, and they have that counter set to tick up every 11 seconds. That would be accurate for the absolute peak month of border crossings we've ever had in the United States, which was December of last year. We saw 250,000 border crossings that month. But crossings dropped by half since then. And a more accurate counter based on the latest numbers would have it tick up every 20 seconds or so. They haven't updated it because they want the numbers to look as big and scary as possible. And they'll shape the data to suit that narrative. That's why they don't cite their sources, and that's why I can't take them seriously as a source of information.
Okay, harsh but fair assessment from our resident data nerd. Moving on, I want to get into another data set, and that's the relationship between immigration status and criminal behavior.
Yeah, so I think it's a major stereotype that people who are here unlawfully commit all kinds of other crimes too. But the data doesn't bear that out. According to the libertarian think tank Cato Institute, illegal immigrants have a lower homicide conviction rate than U.S. citizens. And legal immigrants are even lower. Unlike FAIR, Cato was really transparent about where they got this data, from the Texas Department of Public Safety. So this data is just for Texas, but given that state's high rate of both legal and illegal immigration, I think it's a good case study. Overall, the author at the Cato Institute found that the illegal immigrant homicide conviction rate is 15% below that for native-born residents.
And it's not just for homicide. A study from Stanford found that since the 1960s, immigrants are 60% less likely to be incarcerated than U.S.-born people. And I can say, just anecdotally, having worked with a lot of undocumented people, they are incredibly cautious, like hesitant to go out for a drive with a busted taillight.
Yeah, and data cited by NPR shows there's no correlation between more undocumented immigrants and more crime. I think there's often a political message that everyone who crosses the border unlawfully is part of a cartel or something, but that is truly not the case.
Right. We've heard plenty of conservative pundits, including Nick Craig, describe a daily occurrence of violent crime committed by people in the country illegally. And in case you think I'm exaggerating those claims, here's Craig from a show he did last week where he spent almost a half an hour talking about Rachel Keith's reporting on Mosley, a newcomer school, and immigrants in New Hanover County.
I don't disagree with the idea, the concept of people coming to the United States to try and get a better, to try and make a better life for themselves. But unfortunately, what we are seeing right now is not that, ladies and gentlemen. Every single morning or every single afternoon, depending on what time I'm checking on things, there is a story of somebody being murdered in some place across the United States by an illegal immigrant. Every single morning. Because we're not doing our due diligence at the border. We are allowing dangerous, hardened criminals to waltz into the country and quote-unquote assimilate into society.
Now, just Googling through news stories and also looking at data put out by the Customs and Border Patrol, that seems to be a significant exaggeration. CBP reported a peak of 62 homicide convictions by undocumented people in 2022, and that's the highest number in recent years. For example, last year, it was less than half of that. So, not daily. But even a few a month is still, no doubt, enough to make a politicized point on the right. All that said, I don't think any case has recently been as heavily politicized as the murder of Laken Riley.
Yeah, she's the nursing student from Georgia that President Biden spoke about in his State of the Union in response to chants from Republicans to, quote, say her name. It doesn't get any more political than that.
Right. She was allegedly killed by a man from Venezuela who is here in the United States illegally. And while Riley's father, who does support former President Trump, has gone on record saying he's unhappy with how his daughter's death has been politicized, she has become a posthumous lightning rod for the debate on immigration policy. And look, I can say, I actually agree with the Cato Institute when they argue that no one who has been the victim of a violent crime or whose loved one or friend has been the victim of a violent crime committed by someone in the country illegally is going to be cheered up by the data that we're crunching right here. I'm sure people in Riley's family and circle of friends cannot avoid playing what if. What if her killer had been stopped, deported, or never allowed in at all? It's a deeply emotional and completely understandable response. But if you look at the data, you are far more likely to be assaulted or killed by a legal U.S. citizen, most likely by someone you know, not by a stranger from some faraway country.
Right. And from the data, we can say the chances that the immigrant in line with you at the grocery store is a hardened criminal is incredibly unlikely. So bottom line, we're not telling people how to feel about the debate over immigration reform, but we hope that people at least have some solid data to help form those opinions.
And we will have links to those sources for the data we used in the show notes. All right, Kelly Knoyer, thanks for being here and helping us get a handle on this data.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I'm here with my colleague, Rachel Keith. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So we've talked a lot about some of the myths and misinformation about immigrants and refugees and migrants. We've crunched some numbers. But before we end today's show, I want to get a better, more human understanding of who are we actually talking about at a more direct level than just here are some percentages and numbers. And you spoke with a number of people who are involved with refugee resettlement or immigration in a number of different ways. And first amongst those was Dr. Amanda Boomershine. Just give us a little bit of a pocket bio for her and how she works with this community.
Yeah, she's a UNCW associate professor in the Department of World Languages and Cultures. She also works with UNCW's Latino Alliance, and she's also a member of the New Hanover County Hispanic Latino Commission. And she does volunteer at the Church of World Services Wilmington, who help to resettle refugees here. And she was telling me that migrants who come to this community and potentially their parents were immigrants, but they were born here. I mean, this community is very rich and they are in all types of professions here in the county. And so she's talking about what kind of jobs they're doing here to dispel they're not working in one specific job or the other.
They're building our homes. They're repairing our homes. They're cooking the food in our restaurants that we go to. They're washing the dishes. They're caring for our children. They're cleaning our homes. They're also professionals. They're dentists. They're attorneys. They're physicians. They're teachers. They're professors.
So I think that speaks to some of the stereotyping that we hear about the lines of people waiting for construction work at Home Depot in the morning or stuff like that. Like, yes, that is part of the picture and the data backs that up, but it is far from the whole picture. I think another thing that Amanda spoke to you about was about the motives. What would motivate someone to leave their home country, their native culture, their family, any sense of, you know, stability and history? So she spoke to that, and here she's talking about that issue.
No one chooses to come to the U.S. and leave behind everything for fun. So everyone that is here because they really could not live or support their children, feed their children, educate their children where they were living. And I think that's something that we really need to think about.
And that's what we've discussed on this show, is that people are coming here for a purpose, to work, to preserve their families, to live healthier lives. It's not some nefarious reason that drive most people.
Right. This is not the Great Replacement. You know, this is not an alien invasion for the purpose of destabilizing our American white Christian democracy. That's not what we're talking about. I also want to get into some of what Wes Magruder told you. And he's the director of the Church World Services in Wilmington, where Amanda Boomershine volunteers. And he has experience with refugees. And as we've unpacked on this show, there's a Venn diagram of immigration, migration, and refugees. But he works specifically with people who are being resettled as part of federal refugee programs.
Yes. And this is relatively new. There was a prior nonprofit here, but this specific one has only been in operation for a couple of years. And last year, they resettled 109 people, and half of those were children. And this year, they're allowed to support 180 people. And he's talking about they are one of the most highly vetted people in this country, that oftentimes for refugees to come to this country, it takes anywhere from 7 to 20 years for them to get a green card, a social security number, and they have to work. And they do come with really difficult circumstances because they've fled violence. They've lived, again, in these refugee camps for years on end because their livelihoods were threatened. So in this particular case, he's talking about the Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar that are here now and some of their really difficult stories that they share with him.
And some of those people have been in the camps for closer to 20 years. You know, every family that comes has a different story. They're all equally heartbreaking and they're all equally challenging. Length of time in a camp or, you know, I see their bio data and, you know, a high percentage have been tortured, you know. So I don't know their individual stories exactly. They're grateful to be here.
And one of the things that you noted in your reporting, which we'll have links to on the show page, is that this is literally not a free ride. I mean, down to reimbursing the United States government for the airfare from their country of origin. And so I think a lot of the myths that they are, you know, somehow a leech on public resources is given the lie by that reporting. I also think it's worth noting that we do see these long delays. This is not a quick and easy process. The vetting process, as you note, takes a long time. We are just now going to start to see the beginning of the process of people leaving Ukraine. And I imagine in 4 or 5 years from now, we'll be talking about refugees from Haiti, which is experiencing extreme political violence right now.
Yeah, and he said the majority of the families here in New Hanover County, they come right now from Syria and the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's also seeing an increasing number of Afghans. We're also seeing an increase in refugees from Latin American countries, for example, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and Venezuela. So they're a very diverse community. And like we said, they have to work. They have to take the first job that they're offered. And Magruder said that they get an X amount that they can resettle each year. And so basically they have 9 months to get off their feet and then they have to focus on the next group that's coming in. And he said the first group he was excited because one of the families finally got enough money to earn their first car. So they have the celebrations of working hard and contributing to this community.
I want to pull back the camera a little bit and talk more about the broader category of people who are coming to this country. And Dr. Andres Afanador, he kind of spoke to sort of the underlying level of xenophobia about people who are coming to the United States who don't look like them.
And he is the vice chair of the New Hanover County Hispanic and Latino Commission, and he is a son of immigrant parents.
And they don't understand why they're coming here, and they're perceived as scary. The perception is that they're coming to take my job, or they're members of gangs, or they are criminals. But the truth is, the vast majority are good people who are here to make a better life for themselves.
Part of this conversation is we see these tropes in the comments, we hear it referenced in the call to the audience, and we see it in the public discourse in general, as again, this idea that immigrants are stealing public resources or somehow getting federal benefits or food stamps or EBT cards, stuff that, you know, Kelly and I helped debunk a little bit. But it's not just that they're not a leech on the public purse, it's actually part of our economy.
Yes, that's right. And he said as a physician, he looks at data and the data is just not convincing to him to say that immigrants or migrants aren't contributing, again, economically to North Carolina and to New Hanover County.
Right now, there's pretty abundant evidence that they're contributing to the economy. They're spending millions of dollars and billions of dollars in North Carolina. And so this is a good thing for us. You know, that kind of leads to the labor force. So if we can get people who are here on guest visas who are working, they contribute to our economy, right? Doing hard labor and doing physical labor that generates billions of dollars, whether it's in agriculture or construction.
So recently, the Department of Commerce for North Carolina last March published a data set about foreign-born share of industry workers. And in construction, they constitute 30% of that workforce. And for agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting, it's close to 24%. So they are contributing a lot working in these industries.
I want to take this conversation now back to where we started, which is in the schools. And one of, I think, the underlying issues here is this concern that there are people who have immigrated illegally to the United States, that there are, quote unquote, illegal immigrants, illegal aliens here in our schools. And we do have some nationwide data that Kelly and I talked about a little bit, but it's hard to get granular at the district level. And that's because we have a federal obligation to give an education, to provide an education for students regardless of their immigration status. And you spoke to Dr. Eleni Papamihil about this issue.
Yes, she's a UNCW professor, and she's been working with multi-language learners or ESL learners, English as a second language learners, for a very long time, for a large amount of her career. And she described a federal court case that was decided in the 1970s, and it's called Plyler versus Doe, that schools cannot ask about immigration status technically.
And it was determined that children, K through 12 kids, are always allowed to attend a public school. They can't be charged any money, any extra money, any extra fees, and schools are not allowed to ask their documentation status. They're not allowed to ask for a social security number. We get a profile, but there are some limitations as to what do we talk to the family about.
And they basically get this profile, she said, through when they sign up for school. Do you speak something outside of English in the home? And that kind of triggers like how they can help these students, and they might need services so that they can understand what is being expected of them in terms of their education and their students' education. So here is Wes Magruder again. He is saying that, again, he works with these refugee families. And again, they said that their English proficiency is, it's very wide ranging. Some are limited. Some are speaking English very fluently. But he's saying that the school system in New Hanover County and all school systems should provide something called a language line. So teachers can call this line and be connected to someone who speaks that language and can translate school directions or homework assignments. And here he is on how well the schools are using this resource that they're mandated to have.
We find that it's not always happening. And I think it's just because it's a little bit harder. It takes a little bit extra time to do that. We would highly prefer that, though, to using Google Translate, because Google Translate is just notoriously flawed.
But he did say that one of the parent liaisons at the school district, Maria Black, is very helpful in these families and getting them support. But the teachers, we've talked about this on several newsroom episodes, they are dealing with a lot of different issues, and they are supposed to use this, but it sounds like it's not being taken up all the time.
So I want to talk a little bit more about some of the other challenges the school district faces with people who may be new to the country or may be coming from a family that's new to the country. And going back to Dr. Papamihiel talking about what the school has to do in sort of in addition to the nuts and bolts of our regular academic curriculum.
When they get here, it's not just, well, let's talk about algebra or let's talk about science. It's let's talk about you and your family and your culture and your language needs before we can ever get to those academic discussions.
And that obviously takes resources. I mean, one of the reasons, whether you'd be in favor or against it, that Guilford County set up one and then another newcomer school was that this sort of allows all of that extra work to get done alongside a traditional DPI curriculum. But that is where you put all your resources for getting people up to speed. The problem is when you don't have something like that, it means more challenges in the classroom, and those challenges can get compounded by the level of strain that school's already under.
Yes, and they've talked about many times, and educators talk about this, the Maslow hierarchy of needs. You know, are there immediate needs being taken care of so that they can learn, so they can do higher cognitive tasks? And she's also saying, like, can you imagine if you were a refugee student from the Democratic Republic of Congo and one of the parents is still in the camp, and how would you deal with that on a regular basis? And some of these students go through that. It's a cultural acclimation that they have to go through in order to, okay, I'm ready to do my algebra assignment. It's just, again, acclimating to your surroundings so that you feel safe enough to start learning.
And as we heard from Dr. Papamihiel, that can be difficult when you're in a school that is already strained by, say, a large number of low-income students or Title I. You know, it's a Title I school, a lot of free and reduced lunch students. That's just one additional level of challenge that our school district specifically is dealing with.
Holly Tree Elementary School here in New Hanover County. High socioeconomic population, very low minority student population, very highly resourced school. That's not where you're going to find the English learners. You're going to find them in the schools with the highest needs. So already this teacher has an entire classroom of high-need students, native English-speaking students and English learners. And so it's almost like we're piling high need upon high need upon high need. And it's really difficult. It's a challenge.
From my reporting on the turnaround task force that the county schools have created, and one of these meetings invited the district principals. And again, this task force was created to address some of the issues in some of the lowest performing schools. And the principals at some of these schools are saying they have very high multi-language learner populations and that they do need additional support. And they do need these things called parent liaisons in addition to the language line, that their wish would be to have this resident liaison at the school. So when parents come up to the school or the kids are struggling in the classroom, that this person can go in and help support the family or the students so that they can learn, because they might need a little more explanation. And as Dr. Papamahiel has said, that teachers, general education teachers, they have so many things on their plate. So if one person could be there to help with that, that would be ideal. And then we've also learned that New Hanover County reflects what the state population is. It's about 10% to 11% of that student population are multi-language learners. And the data that, for example, Assistant Superintendent Dr. Patrice Faison has presented is that multi-language learners are increasing each academic year. So these student populations are continuing to come. And we know, again, that they are, since we have the neighborhood school model, they are concentrated in some of these lower income neighborhoods. And so that's what she's talking about, need upon high need. That's what she's referring to.
Yeah. And one thing I just want to drive home for the cheap seats here is that, once again, we have not seen evidence that opening a newcomer school would lead to a new influx of immigration. And we know that the immigrant population is already here in New Hanover County. And yes, the schools are struggling to deal with that. But I wouldn't want the takeaway to be, well, that means we've got to somehow slam the borders to New Hanover County and not let any more students in. Because even though we don't have granular data on New Hanover County specifically, if we extrapolate from national data, we know that the majority of these students are natural-born or naturalized U.S. citizens. And even the ones who aren't, as you pointed out, we have a federal obligation to educate them. And so the sense that somehow all of this is evidence for the need to basically put up walls around New Hanover County, I hope that that's not what people take away from it. And there's another part of this, too, is that regardless of what we do or don't do in the school districts, there will be people who are here illegally. There will be people who are here legally, both who need help acclimating to the U.S. education system and to the English language. But they don't disappear as soon as they go out of high school. Many of them will stay in our community, and what they do with their lives and how they benefit and how they benefit our community, to what extent they become successful, productive members of New Hanover County's community, depends on how good of a job we do in those schools. So here's Dr. Papamahiel getting right to that point.
It's not like any of these students are going to disappear after graduation. They're going to be in our communities working at a successful job or not, depending on how well we prepare them.
And going back to that Department of Commerce report, it says here, quote, immigration will continue to be linked to labor market conditions in the state. In years and decades to come, demographic forces will continue to shape the state's economy, chief among them an aging population. Although immigration cannot entirely counteract the state's workforce challenges, immigration may serve to alleviate some of these headwinds, and that helps our economic future as well. So again, it's important how the schools prepare these students to go out into the workforce, because they will be here.
Yeah, and here's where I want to end, is that we have talked about this issue in terms of politicized narratives and people going, frankly, disturbingly off the deep end along those narrative lines. And we've talked about this story from the point of view of data. And we've talked about this story through the eyes of people who work with immigrants and refugees. But I think all of this kind of gives you a 30,000-foot view. And before we leave this story, I want to just come back to something that Dr. Afanador told our colleague, Cami Mojica.
So often, their statistics or their numbers or their migrants or illegals, but the bottom line is we're talking about human beings.
So If there's any takeaway you take from today's show, whether you agree or disagree with how we've parsed the narratives or the data, I hope people remember that. Rachel Keith, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to my colleagues, Kelly Kinoyer, Rachel Keith, and Camille Mojica for their help with this show. Thanks also to the WHQR technical team, Ken Campbell and Mark Breedy. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast. If you have questions or comments about this show or ideas for a future show, you can reach us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.